This podcast brought to you by Hope 103.2.
Hello and welcome to the Hope Mornings Weekly Podcast. I'm Katrina Rowe. Could your boss be making you sick? New research shows that being overworked and micromanaged could be making employees physically unwell. So what can you do about it? We get some ideas from the report's author, Professor Sam Harvey. Can you imagine living in a post-antibiotic era in which currently treatable infections could lead to amputations or even death? The WHO is warning that superbugs could be the next big health threat as antibiotic resistance increases at an alarming rate. Find out how we can all help to address the problem. Do you force your kids to say sorry? Parenting expert Dr. Justin Colson explains why he doesn't think you should make kids say an apology they don't really mean. Joanna Hayes from the blog Celibate in the City questions some of the traditional youth group explanations for why young Christian women should dress modestly, but raises her own questions about female fashion and sexuality. Young adult author Jessica Shervington talks about her newest book, Disruption, set in an alternative reality in which wearable technology is everywhere and controls every aspect of life, including romance. She talks about her own teen romance with her hubby, former Olympian and Foxtel presenter Matt Shervington, and how it's influenced her writing. Finally, Simon Smart from the Centre for Public Christianity reviews The Invisible Woman. The Ralph Fiennes-directed movie is all about a romantic relationship between Charles Dickens and a young actress. But who does he really love? His wife? His mistress? Or his own celebrity? And this week I also had a chat with the star of the Baz Luhrmann production Strictly Ballroom, the musical, about playing the role Paul Mercurio made famous. That interview is also available in a separate podcast on the Hope 103.2 website. Thanks for listening to the Hope Mornings Weekly Podcast. I hope you enjoy it. Do you know somebody who is absolutely miserable at work? So often it seems to spill over and affect their physical health with headaches, tiredness, back problems, that kind of thing. Well, a new study of more than 7,000 people has found that people working in high-stress offices are more likely to need time off and to experience actual physical symptoms of illness. Dr. Sam Harvey is a psychiatrist and a researcher at the Black Dog Institute. He's the author of this study. Hi, Sam.
Hello.
So what kinds of physical symptoms did people who were stressed out at work experience?
Well, in this study, they had a range. I mean, we asked about a huge number of symptoms, from simple things like headache and stomach aches to shortness of breath and a whole range of things. And what we found in this study was it was just their total symptom load was higher. Mm. There's been other research looked previously at things like depression and anxiety and heart disease, and we know all of those are increased with certain types of work stress.
Okay, well, most jobs can be stressful at times. What was it in particular that you identified as being a problem?
It seems to be particular combinations that are a problem. So it's when you're in a high-stress environment, but when that is combined with other things such as, in this case, having low control over what you're doing, something called decision lassitude. And so that seemed to be the particularly unhelpful combination.
So is that what people talk about with the idea of, you know, being micromanaged, where someone's kind of interfering in every little decision that you make?
I think that's one example of it. I think it's quite a broad idea, but I think that's a really, that's a very clear example of where you're just not able to decide what you do from minute to minute. But we know that actually just that broad thing about how in control you feel it at your work, be it by minute to minute things or be it whether you can come up with a solution to a problem you've identified. I think if people don't have that sense of control, then it seems to be quite a risk factor both for their health and for sickness absence.
Mm. Well, when someone's in a bad situation at work, you know, it can go on for years. So what sort of things could an employee do to make sure it doesn't get so bad that, you know, for example, they can't even work anymore or something like that?
Yeah, I mean, we're doing quite a lot of work with the partners at the Black Dog Institute about trying to think about what are the practical things that one can do as a result of these findings. And I think increasingly we're realising that it's not just about isolating one thing and changing it. It's about looking at the whole culture of the workplace and making sure that managers are well trained to be able to identify when people are in trouble. And actually, if you get some of those climate culture things right from the top, then a lot of these things fix themselves. But in terms of practical things, some of the things people have looked at, it's just really simple ways of people being able to get more control, like being able to be involved in scheduling their own shifts or having meetings, having groups that have true powers to be able to solve some of the problems they see.
Okay, and so for the bosses listening, what do you reckon they can learn from this?
The thing is, it's not it's different to perhaps a lot of workplace health and safety that we've thought about previously, where something simple like dust exposure, it's something easy you can measure and then reduce. And these sort of things are a bit more complicated. And actually, it's about thinking at every layer of your business, from the CEO down to the managers, down to the workplace, about thinking what can one do at each one of those levels to make sure that we have the workplace as health promoting as possible.
Yeah, it sounds like to some extent it's kind of about employees feeling that they're empowered at work.
I think that's it. And actually, you know, if you look at that combination between demand and control, often an employer can't do much to impact the level of demand that is on their workforce at a particular time. But what they can do is help them feel more in control of what's going on. And you know, there are lots of benefits for that. But one of the things we're showing here is around health and sickness absence.
Mm. I guess before we finish up, it would be good to kind of talk just in general about the role of work in our mental health, because I imagine that in general, probably work would be good for our mental health. Is that the case?
Absolutely, yeah. There's really good evidence now that in most situations, work is good for people's mental health. And indeed, we know this if you look at what happens when people are at risk of losing their job, or when they do lose their job. We know that has a major impact on their mental health. If we look at the global financial crisis, an extra 5,000 suicides across Western Europe and North America from that, and that seems to be largely attributable to job losses. So, yeah, work should be a thing that's good for our mental health, and what we're trying to do is just sort of work out how we can maximise that benefit.
Yeah, sounds good. Thanks so much for filling us in on your research.
No problems. Thanks for taking interest.
Yeah, that's Sam Harvey. He's from New South Wales Uni and the Black Dog Institute, and he's the author of this study that we've been talking about this morning. The World Health Organization is warning that we may be on the cusp of a post-antibiotic era where people die of infectious diseases that are currently treatable. Resistance to antibiotics is creating a major global health threat. Professor Peter Collingham is a professor and physician in infectious diseases at the Australian National University. I think I've caught him on his rounds, have I, this morning, Peter?
Yeah, I'm currently at Canberra Hospital looking at patients.
Okay. Can you explain firstly what's meant by the term superbugs? Because, you know, it just sounds like bugs that are super strong, but this is really more about resistance to antibiotics, isn't it?
Yeah, what superbugs means is really these bacteria have got a bulletproof vest on them, so that when we fire antibiotics at them, they bounce off. Usually they're not necessarily stronger than the standard one, but on occasion they can be, because they can have things called toxins, which then give them added ability to also, you know, cause more disease as well.
Okay.
But generally the big thing about them is the antibiotics don't work. They really basically bounce off the protection they've put on.
And this is just because resistance has built up over time?
Yes, it's because, when antibiotics were first put into use really in the early 50s, the vast majority of bacteria were sensitive to the antibiotics we had available and subsequently available. But what happens with time, because bacteria are so good at, you know, like evolving to meet the situation, is they either mutate and develop resistance, or more likely pick up resistance from somewhere else. And then that particular bacteria that's resistant gets an advantage when you put antibiotics into the area. It gets in high numbers and then spreads to other people or to other animals or through the environment via water and food to other people.
Yeah, I guess you're kind of giving it an unfair advantage, aren't you, when you wipe out all the others?
Well, we'll give it an unfair advantage, firstly, because there's more bacteria in sort of my body and your body than there ever have been people on Earth, and they can multiply every 15 minutes, and they have a lot of promiscuous sex with each other, so they genetically, you know, they change their genetic material from bacteria to bacteria very easily. So,
yeah, so what are the risks for public health if bacteria continue to develop resistance at the rate that they are now?
Well, the real problem, and we're lucky in Australia, we have much lower resistance rates than, for instance, India and China. In a lot of those countries, there's not the cusp of untreatable infections. Half the infections, such as E. coli, are for practical purposes untreatable already. So, you know, in a lot of areas of the world, this isn't just theoretical, this is real. But in Australia, the problem is if we get a lot of resistance, you get more deaths and suffering. Basically, if you look back in the 1920s and 30s before we had antibiotics, if you had golden staph in your blood, there was an 80% chance that you would not survive more than 30 days. And a common bug called E. coli, if in Europe they did a good study that showed if you had what we call an ESBL, which is one resistant to all the D-lactamases or third generation cephalosporins, then that actually meant you had a 3 times higher death rate if the bug was in your blood. And if you did survive, you were in hospital on average 5 to 7 days longer than people who had the same bug, but one that would respond to antibiotics. So basically it causes more death and it causes more destruction. And these are required in the community now as equally as hospitals, which is a real problem because we're spreading it through the community worldwide and we need to do lots of things to interfere with that.
Well, let's get on to that. What can we do firstly as individuals to help combat this problem?
Well, as individuals, we should take what we can to not pick up infections in the first place, and that's everything from good hygiene, alcoholic hand rubs if you're in high risk situations, and particularly when we travel, making sure the food we eat is effectively doesn't have anything that can cause travelers diarrhea, but more importantly, also these resistant bugs, and that means eating hot food, drinking good quality water, meaning boiled water or one from a reputable dealer, and essentially not having salads and all those things that would have bugs on them that might be viable. Then the other thing we can do as individuals is question whether we need antibiotics. I mean, every time we have antibiotics, it increases our risk of either developing a resistant bug or more likely having one and having it in higher numbers because we've got it from somewhere else. And basically, in Australia, we use 3 times as many antibiotics as, for instance, the Netherlands does. So there's a lot we can do to decrease our antibiotic use without compromising our health, because a lot of antibiotics are given for viral upper respiratory tract infections where we don't get anything from the antibiotic except side effects in the form of rashes and diarrhea, or we help spread then antibiotic resistant bacteria and keep them not only in our cells but run the risk of spreading it to those around us. That's what we can do from an individual point of view, take good care with what goes in our mouth, where we are. I think not having surgery in overseas hospitals is also a good idea, because that's fine if everything goes without according to plan, but about 5% of people probably pick up infections, and then it's very likely to be a very difficult infection.
So you're saying
impossible to treat.
I should cancel that the facelift in Thailand that I had booked in.
Well, basically, my view is that yes, there, you know, some people are marketing these, but there is very big risks if something goes wrong that you'll have a very difficult to treat infection, and or impossible to treat, because we've actually seen that here with people who've been transferred back after having that sort of surgery done. So, you know, it is a problem. And while it may be cheaper for a lot of people, if something goes wrong, both for the individual and the community, we suffer the consequences, not only in the cost, but the cost of antibiotic resistance and those bugs spreading to other people in our community.
It sounds like it's also, I guess, one of those issues that maybe has been neglected because of its global nature. You know, it really requires some international cooperation. So how can we move forward on this on a larger scale?
Well, I think we need to do everything we can within this country, and there's more we can do both with surveillance and having better control. But I think basically this has to be done internationally, which is why WHO and people are so important. We need to have clean water for everyone. That sounds basic, but if we had clean water in developing countries, we would probably halve the resistance rates there very quickly without, you know, doing much more. We do need new antibiotics developed as well, and the problem with that at the moment, most pharmaceutical companies aren't in it because there's not a return to them, because they want to produce a lot of drug and use a lot of it, and that's the antithesis of what we need for antibiotic resistance. We need to use less, and we use it sparingly. So we need a different business model, how we can get companies back into researching and developing antibiotics, because we'll always need new ones because resistance is inevitable. But we can do a lot to slow down the spread and the development of that, and that's everything from not using 3/4 of the world's antibiotics in food animals to make them grow faster. We can raise animals without antibiotics, and the problem with that is it gets in the water supply, the resistant bacteria, and in the food that's produced.
So do you think there should be a ban on using antibiotics in food production like that?
Well, my own personal view is there's certain antibiotics that are last line for people that should not be allowed to be used in food animals. Sure. Third generation cephalosporins, drugs like carbapenems, fluoroquinolones, they should not be allowed to be used at all, and we should not be allowed to use antibiotics routinely in feed, in water, as either growth promotion or what they call preventative therapy, because if you have to use continuous antibiotics, after a while they don't even work. But secondly, it shows there's a problem with the way you're raising animals, because resistance is inevitable. So you have to find less crowded ways of getting animals together. And it's not as that can't be done. It's been done in countries like Denmark. It's been done in even a lot of places like the US. And to a large degree, we do that in Australia. If you look at our cattle, the vast majority of our cattle are open pasture cows that do not get antibiotics. It's only when you put them in cattle feedlots, put them together, crowd them together, that's when they get sickness and you need something. So it's not that you can't do it. It just requires a change in the way we use animals, and we've got to be very careful about factory farming and that how we do that.
Well, it sounds good for the animals as well, doesn't it?
I mean, I think this will be a win-win for animals, and it can be done without huge increase in costs and still produce all the food we need.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for giving us some ideas.
Okay.
That's Professor Peter Collingham. He's a professor in infectious diseases at the Australian National University. Getting kids to say sorry isn't always the easiest thing to do. We've all seen a parent tearing their hair out trying to make a stubborn child apologise, and when they eventually do, it's sort of spat across the room in a burst of resentment. Family expert Dr. Justin Colson from happyfamilies.com.au believes you shouldn't force your kids to say sorry when they don't really mean it. Hi, Justin.
Good day, Katrina.
Now, before we get on to this, congratulations on your new arrival, baby number 6.
Yeah, thank you. We had the baby 3 weeks and 1 day ago. She's 22 days old today. We're very excited.
You have a full house, man.
6 girls. It was our 6th baby girl.
Oh, you're lucky.
I think so, too.
I adore girls. Now, this happened to me yesterday afternoon, Justin. My niece accidentally hurt my daughter. My daughter was extremely upset by it, and so my sister and I insisted that my niece apologise. But it was, as you say, kind of spat out. So you think that's kind of a pointless exercise, do you?
Well, there's two ways to look at it. Number one, we can look at it as, well, you know, if we get our kids to go through the motions, at least they understand that apologies are required when somebody gets hurt or when they do the wrong thing. And that's fine, but I really think that it ends up being quite meaningless, and I'm not sure that kids learn anything except that big people can make you do stuff you don't want to do. My thinking is a little different to that. My feeling is sometimes it's better to wait until kids have calmed down and we can work with them and help them to understand what's going on so that then they can give real apologies. We can encourage them and direct them towards real apologies rather than that whole resentful, I'm sorry, not sorry kind of thing.
But what if they really don't want to do it and they don't get to that point where they're happy to do it? Then do you think you should force them, or would you just let it go?
That's a really interesting question. My eldest daughter, 14 years old, recently did something that she just wasn't sorry about. And I had a conversation with her about it once things had calmed down and suggested that an apology would probably be in order because somebody had been quite hurt by what had occurred. And her response was, Dad, I'm not going to apologise if I'm not sorry. Now, obviously, there's a little bit of a moral dimension to this, and she needs to mature more morally so that she can recognise that sometimes it's just good to be conciliatory and to apologise even if you're not sorry.
That's true. I mean, sometimes even as adults, we have to say sorry when we don't really want to. Now, sometimes it might be that we know we're in the wrong and it's still hard to say, but other times it might be that we feel like it's unfair. But as adults, we force ourselves to do it, don't we?
Well, we do, although I still think that those kinds of apologies are not received as real apologies because people do get a sense that we don't mean it. And so with my daughter, to go back to that original question, with my daughter, I just said, well, take some more time, think about it some more. I think that as you consider the circumstances a bit more, you'll probably agree soon enough that it's an appropriate thing to apologise here. Okay. And eventually she did. It took her a few days, but eventually she did. Mm-hmm. With a couple more, you know, gentle reminders. But I think that what we need to do more than anything with our kids, when we force the apology, all we do is we make them think, I'm not sorry, and I hate you now as well as hating the other person that's, you know, requiring the apology. It only breeds this resentment and this frustration and this powerlessness. I'm much more inclined to suggest that when our kids do the wrong thing, when they do something that requires an apology, we wait until the moment has passed, if they're really fired up. If they still haven't apologised, then we sit and talk with them and we do something quite powerful. We get them to take the perspective of the person who's been slighted. We say, how do you think that person felt when that occurred? And once they can start to do that, we can help them to craft an apology. So we might say, if you were to say sorry, what would you say sorry for? In other words, we're encouraging them to not just say sorry, but they're going to say, I'm sorry, I know that what I did was not kind, or I'm sorry because I know that what I did hurt you. And then we can ask them to also add to that, will you forgive me?
Mm. In a way, you're still making them apologise, but you're just giving them the time and space to do it more in a way that is more natural rather than it being forced in the moment.
I suppose you might say that, but really this still has to be something that they do. Mm-hmm. It's not a forced apology. It's a conversation. When somebody does something like that to you, what do you want them to say to you? So what would be the best thing for you to do now? It's giving the kids the opportunities to develop those answers within themselves.
Okay. Well, thanks for your thoughts this morning, Justin. Good to hear from you.
Always a pleasure. Thanks for chatting.
That's Dr. Justin Colson now, father of six girls, a parenting author, and the founder of happyfamilies.com.au. I'm sure we've all been in the situation when we're out and about and we see someone and we think, what is she wearing? Particularly, I'm talking about a woman with a super short skirt or those really shorty shorts where you can sort of start to see that bum cheek and you think, what is that girl wearing? You know, we all of us have a line where we think that dressing has just gotten a little bit too risque, but that line may be slightly different for all of us. Joanna Hayes from the blog Celibate in the City has something to say about this issue of modest dressing. Hi, Joanna.
Hi, Katrina.
Now, look, going back to the days of youth group when the girls and the boys would be split up to talk about the birds and the bees, this topic of dressing modestly would always get a Guernsey. Yeah, what's your response to that?
I understand why you split up the guys and the girls and you talk to the girls about dressing modestly, particularly because I guess teenagers are pretty much renowned for pushing the boundaries. But I think it was just interesting the reasons that were given for this. And I think as I've grown older, I've become more frustrated with the reasons that are generally given to Christians for why women should dress modestly.
Which are what?
Well, I think there's the usual thing of like, boys are visually stimulated, so you've got to make sure that you're not showing them anything that would stimulate them.
Okay.
Which is just an interesting thing to say anyway. As far as I've been able to figure out through many years of research now, boys can be visually stimulated by girls, whatever they're wearing.
Yeah, that's true.
They are there. That's, you know, oh, look, there is a girl there. I can now be stimulated.
I think also if you go too far down that road of making women responsible for men's self-control, then you end up in a burqa, don't you?
Yeah, and I think, that's the other problem, is that it makes the responsibility for patrolling male sexuality totally on the girls, which there's already enough factors in our society that place all the guilt as well as the responsibility for sexual expression on women. I think that because the boys are visually stimulated idea has become less satisfying to me over time, and also because it's not actually in the Bible, not that everything is in the Bible, but I think it's quite different to the reasons that God's word gives for reasons that women need to dress modestly.
Okay. Joanna, I mean, I guess when we tell girls that they need to cover up because otherwise they may accidentally turn a guy on, there's kind of also buried in there an implicit message that what guys really want and are drawn to is physical beauty, and that therefore sort of paradoxically that's what we need to aspire to if we want to, you know, get a guy's attention.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know?
Like, you know, we're encouraged, you know, particularly, okay, the teenage talk, like we're encouraging the girls to grow in their godliness and become women of godly character, at the same time telling them that boys are visually stimulated, so they're just going to go for someone who's hot. like, I've never had a guy say to me, wow, your gentle and quiet spirit is really tempting to me. and I'm pretty sure no other woman in the history of the world has either. So, yeah, it kind of reinforced the message that society already gives. Guys are just looking for someone hot. So certainly myself, and I'm sure a few of my friends and others have also thought, oh, well, this doesn't apply to me because nothing I wear could be visually stimulating enough to make a guy be interested in me. So, yeah, it also just reinforces that problem that there already is for teenage girls.
Look, the reality is too, Joanna, that most of us do follow fashion, and for the past year or two, you know, fashion has been short and sometimes really, really short.
Yes. Certainly, particularly for teenage women and young adult women, the way that fashion kind of moves and sort of the message that's been there for quite some time now is the purpose of your existence is to be a hot clothes source. So we're going to sexualize you as much as possible. That includes using parts of your body that are personal and intimate to be on display and giving you clothing that means that should you ever raise your arms slightly or, I don't know, run for the bus, carry some shopping, give a lecture. If you do anything that's actively participating in the world, your clothes are going to reveal more of you than you would want to.
Well, Joanna, just look at what some of the women were wearing at the Logies, if you're thinking about revealing parts that, you know, are normally private, I mean.
Exactly. And it's basically just like, oh, if the clothes that society is telling me I should wear say to me, sit or stand still and never do anything, simply be here as an object for the male gaze.
So I guess you could say
that's probably a problem.
Yeah, they're kind of disabling in the way that very high heels can be disabling. And so when exactly. when women wear that, they're kind of saying, you know what, I'm not good for anything except to be looked at.
Exactly. Mm. I can't run anywhere today. I'm in 6-inch stilettos. So, yeah, I think that's been one of the reasons that I think, yeah, it is okay for me to be slightly repulsed by a lot of current fashion because, you know, while the girls at my church are kneeling at the communion rail, that shouldn't be a moment of like, we are now on display completely. We've knelt down to receive communion. If the clothes that young women are being told to wear is all about stand still and look pretty, those are just not messages that I think we should be accepting. Mm. The Bible does have stuff to say about modesty in dress, but mostly, particularly in passages like 1 Timothy 2, what is being spoken about is actually the costliness of clothing.
Oh, so not being extravagant in your clothes or showing.
Yeah, not being okay. extravagant. So, and I think that's actually a message that we probably do need to think about and hear when we think about why should women be modest in dress. I shouldn't be spending, you know, so much on my clothes, investing in that instead of investing in worshipping God. Don't clothe yourself in expensive, flashy clothing, but clothe yourself in good deeds.
Good call. Thanks for filling us in on that, Joanna.
That's all right.
Joanna Hayes from the blog celibateinthecity.net about what it really means to be modest in dress. We've been hearing more about wearable technology and how it might very soon be impacting on our lives. Devices that measure our heart rate, blood sugar and hydration are on track to becoming a daily reality. But a new novel by Jessica Shervington takes that concept a step further. In Disruption, M-bands, a wearable evolution of the smartphone, are compulsory and control many aspects of daily life, including romance. Author Jessica Shervington's on the line. Hi, Jessica.
Hi, Katrina.
The idea for this book, I mean, where did that come from?
Originally, it was just that really simple idea when you're walking down the road and you're crossing paths with people and everyone's on their phones and they're on their iPads. And I just remember saying to my husband, wouldn't it be weird if you could just walk past someone and get a rating and you're looking down at your phone or your iPad and you get this rating and you know if you're compatible with them as like friends or in business or in romance. And that sort of started this whole story idea, which was pretty weird. But once I sort of started researching it and then brought the idea of microchipping into it, which is a technology that we're really on the cusp of anyway.
And understand that you had a few issues yourself while you were researching this book. Did you?
Yeah, I had some interesting times. It's becoming sort of one of my favourite parts of writing, the research process. And this book is set in Arlington in Virginia. And so I headed over there to do a research trip because I was really looking for somewhere that I could put, you know, when you're dealing with this big corporations, I wanted them to have this sort of big villains layer. So I looked into the FEMA locations around America, and they've got a massive site out in Bluemont, Virginia. And this is a site that's basically set up to run America in the event of catastrophe. It's where the president was taken after 9/11, for example.
Wow. Yep.
Yeah, but it's all underground. So when you go there, it's really hard to see anything. It looks really kind of basic. It's in the middle of nowhere. It just looks like these, you know, one-level buildings, but just a lot of security. So I couldn't find much else on it. So I went there and I found this article that a journalist had written in the Guardian newspaper in the UK, and he had sort of been on a similar research trip, and he met a number of people and finally was introduced, taken to this little pub, which is sort of, again, in the middle of nowhere, with nothing else around it. And he met the owner, and he was an ex-CIA operative, and he had worked in the site. So he told him some things about the FEMA site below ground. So I did the same thing. I just thought, well, okay, he got that far, so I'll try and do the same thing. So I went out to try and find this pub in the middle of nowhere. And I ended up having the most incredible experience. I spent about 4 or 5 hours there, and I had to first wait for him to sort of come in, and then I met his wife, and then their nephew's bluegrass band came in, and they were all playing, and the locals started filtering in, and the owner, his name was Jim Fink, which is probably one of the best CIA names I've ever heard anyway. And gradually through the night, he'd come and talk to me a little bit more each time. And in the end, he sort of took me into his office where he had all these massive frames of all his different identifications that he's had over the years. And he said, you know, I had to return all the aliases, but these are all the ones just in my name, like identifications for every country. Incredible.
Wow.
Letters from the president, letters from the Australian Army, inviting them to have lunch with them on the battlefields. And he was one of the last feet off Vietnam. So very interesting man to talk to.
So did asking all these questions bring you under any suspicion, Jessica?
Well, it was interesting. There were a few moments where it was sort of, I was really upfront with him. And there were a few moments with him where he sort of, you know, walked away and it was very clear he wasn't going to answer particular questions I was asking.
Okay.
But the probably the scariest bit for me was when I actually went driving by the FEMA site. I tried to sort of film that so I could come back and write about it, and I went past it about 4 times, but most definitely for the second, third and fourth pass, there was a very large four-wheel drive behind me. I sort of got worried that they might sort of pull me over or whatever, but it just felt a bit more like a, you know, a gentle escort.
We're watching you.
You were there.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I was a little bit nervous because I'm a little bit of a scaredy cat at the end of the day, so I decided not to do any more passes, and I put my video equipment down and kind of got out of there. But
okay.
Yeah, there are a few moments where I was a little bit nervous.
I'm speaking with Jessica Shervington. She's a young adult novelist, and her latest book is called Disruption. Jessica, you write teen and young adult, you know, romance, and I know that you've said in the past that meeting your husband, former Olympian and now Foxtel presenter Matt Shervington, at a young age kind of means that you take teen romance a little bit more seriously. I guess I'd say you treat it with respect. Do you think that's contributed to your success in this genre?
Yeah, I think so. I do think it's really important to sort of treat the romance element with just as much heart and sincerity as you would if you were writing an adult fiction. Yes, obviously I met Matt when we were 17, and we've kind of gone on and have just had our 13th wedding anniversary and have 2 children now. So, you know, I definitely believe that you can meet, you know, the person at a young age and, you know, have those emotions that are so intense but genuine and real and be able to kind of connect with that. So I do really feel that sometimes, you know, the younger people aren't given as much sort of that sort of brushed aside a bit with relationships and told sort of, you know, oh, you'll go on, you'll have more relationships, or, you know, don't take it too seriously. But sometimes it is really serious, and I think that's come through in my characters when, you know, they've been invested in relationships, and that's always been important to me to put through in my stories.
Yeah. Well, you're first published back in 2010, so it's all still fairly new. What are you enjoying most about your new writing career, Jessica?
Look, I love everything about it. My favourite part is, you know, the early stages where I'm developing an idea and I'm starting to do the research, and I love finding. I get a huge high out of finding something. With Disruption, for me, it was finding research on pheromones and how pesticides were developed using pheromone treatment. So they make pesticides to teach insects not to mate instead of killing them off and damaging the crop. And this process is called Disruption. So it led to the title of the book and a big sort of theme that actually runs through the book, you know, thinking about how dangerous it could be if we actually did have a technology that could monitor and affect our pheromones.
Must be exciting though as well when your book goes international. I know that some of your books have been sold overseas now. Has that been a bit of a game changer for you?
Yeah, it's definitely awesome. I mean, it just makes the whole process that much more interesting from my point of view as well, because you get to work with different publishing houses around the world, and some will even change the title. So seeing the response from readers in different markets is also really good.
Well, congratulations. Yeah. It's always exciting for all of us to see an Aussie doing well on a world stage. So congratulations.
Yeah, thanks, Katrina. Thank you so much.
Yeah, no worries.
Fingers crossed I get to keep doing it.
That's Jessica Shervington. She's the author of many young adult novels. We've been talking to her about her newest offering, Disruption. Charles Dickens was one of the most celebrated and successful British authors of the 19th century. Stories like Oliver Twist, A Tale of Two Cities, A Christmas Carol, and Great Expectations continued to be told on stage, in films, and even the old-fashioned way through the books. But there was one aspect of his life that he kept very quiet, and that was a romantic affair with a young actress. Dickens and Ternan fell madly in love, but Dickens never acknowledged his lover publicly, even after he divorced. The story of this relationship is being told in The Invisible Woman, a new film directed by and starring Ralph Fiennes. Now, Simon Smart is a cultural commentator for the Centre for Public Christianity. He's filling in as my film reviewer while Justine Toe's on maternity leave. Hi, Simon.
Hey, Katrina.
Now, this is a love affair between Charles Dickens and his younger mistress, Nellie Ternan. How much is this story based on what actually happened?
Yeah, well, the film's based on a biographical book by Claire Tomlin, who wrote about the relationship. And the suggestions are that Nellie Ternan was an inspiration for some of Dickens' most famous characters, like Estella from Great Expectations, some people might remember,
yep.
Lucy from A Tale of Two Cities. It's fairly speculative, though. So it's well established that they had a relationship, but the details are fairly scarce. So it's believed that Dickens and Nellie Ternan both destroyed letters and diary entries that would have given us more information about that connection. And so it's sort of speculative, but I think pretty well understood that there was this connection and this relationship.
Okay.
And because of the scarce details, maybe the story suffers a bit because of that limitation.
Okay. Now, Ralph Fiennes directs and stars in this film, and I would expect a fairly kind of sensitive treatment from him. Is that what we experience in this film?
It's a really well-made film. It was nominated for Best Costume Design at the Academy Awards. Not hard to see why. It's meticulously put together. You know, the costumes and the sets. It's very convincing in recreating that period. So people who like period dramas will really enjoy this. It's pretty intense. It's a kind of slow burn atmosphere. It might be a bit slow for some, but if people are interested in these historical characters, they'll find it satisfying. And the acting is brilliant. You get this sort of understated acting and a real sense of the tortured nature of this relationship. Mm. These two who they were sort of deeply in love, but they can't be together in any sort of conventional sense.
Given that the love story is based, around an affair, I mean, Dickens was married. How is that moral question dealt with in the film? Like, Dickens was known publicly as a Christian. You mentioned the characters were kind of tortured. How do they wrestle with the right and wrong of the situation?
He is known as a Christian. You couldn't read A Tale of Two Cities, for instance, and miss the explicit Christian themes in this. It's really hard to know how much he wrestled with the morality of what he's doing. It just seems that he was overwhelmed with his love for Nellie. So at one level, it's kind of a great love story that, as I said, inspired perhaps quite a lot of his writing. There's just a lot of unhappiness for everyone concerned. Mm. There's unhappiness for his wife, for sure, for his family, had lots of kids, for Nellie and for him. They are a bit tortured. She, especially after his death, as she looks back on this relationship. And in the end, she has to make a choice to embrace real life and an actual husband, which he does, rather than this sort of rather romanticised memory of this great writer who she could never really take hold of. It's a really sad story, but very skillfully told.
One thing I know that I'd never realised about Dickens was just how much of a rock star he was in his time. I mean, often with writers, for example, even Shakespeare, their greatest success comes after their death, but Dickens was really famous and really well known wherever he went. How does his fame affect those around him?
Yeah, he's a superstar of the time. He was the most successful writer of his time, and he was well-known. He used to do public readings. He was very successful tours where he'd go around in big theatres and read his work. He's depicted in the film as being a bit caught up in that life. So his wife makes a comment to the young mistress that she would be sharing him with the crowds and could never really tell if he loved her more than the adulation.
Let's hear a little bit of that, what she says there.
He is Mr. Charles Dickens. In those early years together, I could not fail to be impressed. But you will find that you must share him with his public. They will be the constant. And in truth, you will never absolutely know which one he loves the most.
I guess the title, The Invisible Woman, suggests that in a way he chose his public reputation over this love of his life.
Yes, and the convention of the time made it really impossible for him to be overly public about that relationship. It was a bit scandalous even to get divorced, which he did. And then he evidently saw her a lot, but it's not sort of a super public thing. And that type of relationship is always fraught. I think the film's also a bit of a comment on our tendency to elevate people to that sort of status. They might have a great skill in one area, in this case in writing, but we get to the point of idolising them, and then when we come face to face with the real person, we're bound to be disappointed to some degree. Dickens here in the film is presented as having heaps of really excellent qualities, but at the same time he's deeply human and flawed, and you see that play out in all sorts of ways.
Thanks, Simon. Good to catch up with you this morning.
Thanks, Katrina.
That's Simon Smart. He's a cultural commentator with the Centre for Public Christianity. We've been talking about The Invisible Woman. It's directed by Ralph Fiennes, stars Felicity Jones, Kristen Scott Thomas and Joanna Scanlon.